You keep your foot on the gas. Choose life. Are we having a good time yet? This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we're talking about the 1993 film Red Rock West. The film stars Nicolas Cage, Dennis Hopper, Laura Flynn Boyle, J.T. Walsh, and Dwight Yoakam. John Dahl directed the film and co-wrote it with Rick Dahl. John also directed The Last Seduction, Rounders, Joyride, The Great Raid, and You Kill Me, and he's directed an absurd amount of great TV, including Breaking Bad, The Americans, Justified, and Yellowstone. The film holds a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. It grossed $2.5 million on a budget of $7 million. Quickly before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. And if you want to choose an upcoming episode of the show, click on Support This Podcast in the show description and support the show, and we can figure out a movie of your choosing that we both love. My guest today is screenwriter Daniel Cameron. Daniel is a Nickel Fellowship semifinalist, a graduate of the AFI Conservatory Screenwriting Program, and a writer that I've hired back when I was a development executive. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to call you Daniel, otherwise this is going to get super confusing.
Sounds good.
So this movie opens with Nicolas Cage, and it's basically the most manly 5 minutes of a movie I've seen in 20 years. I felt like I had
Absolutely.
A good time. He does the manliest shaving possible, which is shirtless on the side of the road with a mirror.
Yep.
Then he does one-handed push-ups in the middle of the road. And, you know, it's like he's got this whole kind of cowboy outlaw thing going on. And I thought, you know, since we're doing a Nicolas Cage movie, I just want to take 2 seconds to tell my Nicolas Cage story because
I'd love to hear it.
I almost made a movie with Nicolas Cage. I developed a screenplay as an executive that Nicolas Cage was going to star in. We had a 3-hour meeting with his manager about it. And we pretty much got to like the 5-yard line with it. And one of his only requests was that his character dress as this sort of cowboy outlaw style, right?
Okay.
And this was based on a Johnny Cash movie, so that sort of made sense. We had been trying to get it made at that point, I think at least 3 years. And the director, for some reason, said, if we let Cage dress that way, he's going to quit the movie. That's what he said.
Oh.
We fired him, I think, the next day. And then, ironically, we ended up not making the movie anyway.
The director the next day?
Yeah, we ended up firing the director. And then we ended up not making the movie anyway. There ended up being other issues that sort of like some infighting between different camps of producers, and ended up not happening. And it's one of my great regrets of my career not to have one Nicolas Cage movie on my resume.
I mean, Nicolas Cage is fascinating. Like, he seems like such an anomaly of a guy who is not only an incredible actor, but can do these like broad, loud things that somehow still work. And whatever that is, like, have you seen GQ's done those little like sort of retrospectives of actors talking about their most famous roles?
Yeah.
I watched his the other day, and like the depth to which he's thinking about some of these things, like the German expressionism that he's bringing to like these other roles and stuff is like so interesting. He's just obviously so engaged and he's so watchable. And this is him in Red Rock West at such a sort of young nascent part of his career. Like he hadn't really popped yet.
Yeah. This is like low key, like not low key, but like I would say medium key Cage. And then there's a couple of moments where he kind of lets it out of the cage a little bit. And
100%.
You can see the future, but he's more restrained here.
I think one of the things I love about this movie actually is that his character, like he is reacting, which, you know, people say that's bad in a story or a screenplay or whatever, that the character's reacting all the time. But I find it fascinating because you're watching him think about what other people are telling him in this whole thing. And he's trying to parse what their motivations are.
Yeah.
And he has to do so much with actually not that much dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty great performance in that regard.
Yeah, I think underrated in that way. So we meet him, they do a great job. Like in the first 4 minutes, it's basically, he's driven 1200 miles to try to get a job working construction, but they won't hire him because he has a bad leg. So that's that little snippet gets you totally on his side. You understand why he would be tempted to do something criminal. And you have empathy for him. And it's like, it seems simple, but can you talk about how tough that is to do?
I mean, it's very difficult to come up with like a way to empathize with a character that doesn't feel heavy-handed. And I think one of the beautiful things about what this movie does is it's both so on the nose, but it has style. Like it's got a little bit of nuance, even though it's so on the nose. I mean, that sounds like an oxymoron, but somehow they manage it. So for instance, I mean, he doesn't get the job just because he has a bum knee. He doesn't get the job because he tells them that he has a bum knee.
Right.
And so it's him being a totally honest person in that regard. I read some review where they're like talking about after that, he goes to get gas. He's down to his last $5 and he walks into sort of a gas station where there's no attendant up front and there's a full cash register full of cash there and he's broke. And the person's like, yeah, and he doesn't take the money. And I was like, that's not what is important about that scene. What's important about that scene is that he's tempted to take the money.
Right.
You watch him think about it. So this is a fallible man. This isn't a Christ figure, you know? Yeah. He's a person who looks at the cash and is like, man, I really need that right now. And he's like, but I won't take it because that's not who I am. That's not part of my code.
Right.
And once he breaks his code a little bit down the road, that's what gets him into the whole mess. And so that's fascinating. Just quickly back to that first scene where he's doing the push-ups. Like, one thing I love about this movie is it's both a noir and a Western. And after he does the push-ups and he gets dressed, he puts on a white shirt. And later on, Lyle from Dallas, who's sort of his counterpart in this, comes and arrives and wears a black shirt for the entire movie. And it's that kind of white hat, black hat, classic Western trope. And again, that's on the nose, but sort of subtle, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's all very just elegant, right? It's not like...
Right, elegant's a great word.
I think in lesser hands, some of this stuff would have been underlined or highlighted in a way that would have made it feel just kind of over the top, but they do it. It's just elegant. Yeah. I mean, so like you said, he goes to the gas station, he's down to his last $5. The gas station attendant says, hey, go to Red Rock. You might be able to get work there. He goes to JT Walsh's bar and then JT thinks that he's Lyle from Dallas. And he's like, hey, you're Lyle from Dallas, here for the job. Right. And Cage is like, yeah, I'm totally here for the job. And then it turns out that the job is to kill JT Walsh's wife, Laura Flynn Boyle.
Right.
And, you know, it's very like 1993, like there's no smartphones, you know, nobody has a picture of Lyle from Dallas. So Cage goes to Laura Flynn Boyle's house, warns her. She says she'll pay him double if he kills Wayne, which is JT Walsh. It's all very Pulp Fiction novel stuff. He takes the money that she gives him. And then he's king of the 7-Eleven. He spends like $119 at the gas station. And I thought that was like a very relatable scene. Like as both of us being writers, can you relate to both being that poor and then being that excited to have money? Because I know for me, like I've gone to the casino with my last $100 and then lost it. And then I've also in my writing career, I've had times where I'll just get a check, like one check for five figures, you know, and it's the ups and downs that we go through kind of as artists.
I mean, that's great. I think like the filling up with gas and groceries, especially because they've shown you the scene where he's down to his last $5 and like how sort of strapped he is and how, you know, at the end of options he is, and he gets this money and it seems like this crazy windfall. And it's like, it's a kid in a candy store, you know, he's grabbing everything. I think something else that this movie does that's hard to do, I think money is often a fairly boring motivation for movies and it's overused. This movie does a great job of showing why and how it's important to everybody. You know, it's not just that somebody wants $10,000, it's somebody has no dollars. They need some dollars, you know? So now all of a sudden the stakes of money are a little more interesting.
Yeah, it's what it represents.
Yeah, exactly. I think I had this professor, Steve Mazur, who actually co-wrote Liar Liar. He's a really fascinating guy at the AFI. And he used to just constantly say, don't hide the ball. You know, you turn some pages in. And this movie does a great job of not hiding the ball. And I think a lot of writers, when they start out, they want to be subtle or elegant. And they're not. It's a face without a nose instead of being on the nose. You know what I mean? And
it's great advice.
Put it out there.
Don't hide the ball is incredibly good advice. Because most scripts that are painfully boring, it's just very simply, you're hiding the ball. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That simple. And like you said, in this movie, not only did they not have the ball, but in 25 minutes, we've had already a couple of twists here. Now Cage is going to leave town with the money. He hits a stranded motorist in the rain, takes him to the hospital. Turns out he has already been shot. So then the cops tell Cage, it looks like attempted homicide. We're going to call the sheriff. They call the sheriff. Turns out the sheriff is JT Walsh. This is 25 minutes in. We've had like 17 twists. Can you talk about how densely plotted this is? Because really, it almost feels like it's based on a book or something, but it's not.
Right. I mean, the reversals are incredible. And like the little character beats, I mean, quickly back to the money thing. When he hits the guy, he looks down at the money in his pocket as though it's cursed that he's just taken and spent at the gas station. And he tucks it in his glove box, you know? One other thing they established really quickly that's like beautiful, sort of like, again, elegant storytelling is 9 minutes into the movie, he drives past the Welcome to Red Rock sign. 20 minutes into the movie, he drives past the "You Were Leaving" Red Rock sign. And they use that conceit consistently through the movie of him getting caught, brought back. And it's, you know, it's a great, it's a signpost. And that's very sort of classic, old school, like, you know, even like Shakespearean storytelling. And yeah, I think one of the reasons this movie works and clicks along and hums so well and it's so fascinating, and this goes for a lot of the like fairly high quality kind of 90s noirs, is they really do embrace the reversal of fortune. And it's just consistently happening in this movie. Yep. You think it's one thing, he tries to do the right thing, you know, he gets caught. When he realizes J.T. Walsh is the sheriff, that's a great shot. And I read, I think maybe on the IMDb trivia, that that was his idea to look up from under the brim of his cowboy hat and reveal himself as the sheriff, because it's a nice reveal.
Yeah,
it's nicely handled on screen.
So J.T. Walsh takes Cage aside and he basically says, dude, what the fuck is going on? Cage admits everything. He says, hey, I just thought you needed a bartender. J.T. Walsh is like, come on. He doesn't believe him, tries to kill him. Cage gets his gun, runs away. JT pushes him through this extremely spooky forest, like Universal Horror Nights, like the smoke machine is really going there. Cage winds up tripping and falling, losing the gun. He ends up on this nearby road. A car nearly hits him. Guess who's driving that car? Dennis Hopper. Cage asks him for a ride. Hopper gives him a ride. They bond. They're both former Marines. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm writing a pilot right now that's based on the true stories of this Green Beret. And so for me, like, as soon as they both realize they're ex-Marines, I 100% bought, and it'd been a while since I'd seen the movie. I didn't remember. I totally thought they were like going to be bros. Like Dennis Hopper would kill somebody to protect Nicolas Cage. He is personally offended when Cage refuses to get a drink with him, which I totally bought. Do you recall, I mean, in rewatching it, I'm sure you remembered this twist, like how they set you up for that, basically, that it seems like they're going to be friends. And then it's the opposite, basically.
I mean, I love that scene. It's one of the ones that sticks out in the movie and sticks out sort of in my memory of it a little bit. Like when I think about the movie, like one of the things I like about it is that Cage doesn't give much away throughout this entire thing. You know, he's never sort of happy to see somebody. He's not eager ever really. He's sort of reticent throughout the entire thing. And I like reticent characters. It's a difficult thing to do, but this movie does it beautifully. And them sort of feeling each other out and being vaguely, you know, sort of wary of each other. And like, they both kind of have their backs up. It's sort of like two animals in a forest, like hair on end, circling each other. And then they do click over the Marines thing. Another nice thing that I think the scene does is, up to that point, like, we just had a fairly big plot driven action sequence. Like you say, it's the spooky forest. There's been all these reversals. It's kind of been wham, 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 wham. And now it takes the moment to sort of slow down and go into a character beat that I guess ostensibly is his sort of like wound from the past. That's where his knee got hurt, and that, you know, he screams at him, you know, I know I'm lucky 241 guys weren't, when Dennis Hopper realizes that he was part of a particular bomb blast overseas. And it sort of gives him, Dennis Hopper, more respect for Nicolas Cage's character in that moment, and kind of is like them crossing the bridge of like, oh, okay, this is great. I mean, the movie doesn't do that much of that. It doesn't dig into emotional pasts. They kind of check the box, but I like that they slow down there. And they do this thing where, oh, maybe these guys are going to get along.
Yeah.
Leading us to one more twist at the end of the scene.
Right. So it's like Semper Fi. We're going to drink together. Dennis asks the bartender if he knows someone named Wayne. We realize that Dennis is Lyle, the actual hitman, the person JT thought Nicolas Cage was. And it's just on a writing level. It's the movie. This is like a hunter that uses every part of the animal. Every element in this movie is used like six different ways. And that's really hard to do. So JT shows up at the bar, Cage sneaks out the bathroom window, climbs on a truck, escapes, befriends trucker Dwight Yoakam, who gives him a ride, goes to see Laura Flynn Boyle. And, you know, it's, I think that the fact that it's so economical in using these different elements to their maximum kind of ability, you get the sense that it's a calling card movie for John. And what was interesting is that his previous movie, Kill Me Again, has a similar noirish premise, but it hasn't had that second life that this movie has. I never heard anybody really talk about that movie. And so I almost equate it, if you think about Guy Ritchie did Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and then he did Snatch.
Right.
Snatch is the more polished version of Lock, Stock. It's almost like Lock, Stock was like the trial run, and he learned so much doing it that he then did the perfection of it in Snatch. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. Like, I feel like he sort of, the second go round of doing this kind of movie, he just had it down. And back in the 90s, this is the calling card movie, right? You think of Blood Simple, Blue Velvet, it's kind of like that. But in 2020, like, what would be the equivalent of this? It would have to be, I guess, like a, would it be like almost, you think of Gareth Edwards doing Monsters, and then he gets to do Godzilla and Star Wars. Like, I don't know that people still make a movie like this in terms of genre as the calling card movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's much less common. I'm still fascinated in those guys. Like, I mean, Good Time, I guess that's a little bit deeper in those guys' career, but that popped in a totally different way for them from anything they'd done before, because they got Robert Pattinson on board because they'd made something that was so damn good prior to that. You know?
Right.
I love Jeff Nichols. I love Shotgun Stories, his first feature. And then did he do Take Shelter next?
I believe so, yeah.
I think so as well. And so that's... That path still exists, but it's very, very rare these days. I mean,
yeah, I think people are pushed more towards, like, I remember Amazon, there's some movie, it's like Midnight Radio or something. Like, I think people are pushed more towards doing Supernatural or Amblin-esque or something, right, with some heightened element beyond just like reality, basically.
Totally. I mean, I think, to me, what I think of noir and genre movies as sort of adult movies. Yep. And the multiplexes these days, and I think this has always been, you know, predominantly the case, but you're aiming at teenage boys, essentially, I think. And there used to be that middle tier of these sort of more auteurish American filmmakers making genre fare that was somehow elevated, which is my favorite thing. I love a little gritty little crime film that's better than it has any right to be. And that's what this movie is.
Hell yeah.
And I think that those stories move to television, you know?
Yeah,
so you have shows like The Americans and stuff like that, like the stuff that John Dahl's gone and directed, like any of those shows you listed that he's gone and directed TV episodes of.
Justified.
Are, you know, those more adult, more genre stories where people can play and be a little more elevated while working in a sandbox that people understand.
Yeah. So after all this, Cage goes to tell Lara Flynn Boyle what's going on. Dennis Hopper shows up. He's trying to kill them both. Cage gets the drop on him, knocks him out. They take off together. The two cops who initially held Cage in the hospital discover the money he was paid in his car when they impound it. So they're starting to think something's up here. Cage and Lara Flynn Boyle stop for gas and a drink. She explains J.T. Walsh wants her dead so he can keep this insurance money she got. They get a motel room. They have sex. They talk about running away to Mexico, but they need money. So she says, let's go back to Red Rock to rob JT Walsh's safe, which they actually do, but there's very little money in the safe. JT comes in. They hide in his closet. The two cops, who are now suspicious, they come in and arrest JT. The guy who Cage hit, who'd been shot, JT shot him, and he basically told the cops about this, and he knew about this murder-for-hire scheme. They've called the FBI. It seems like everything's going to work out. Then when everybody leaves, Cage sees this wanted poster the cops left behind, and it shows both J.T. Walsh and Lara Flynn Boyle, who are both wanted for stealing $1.9 million from a steel mill. And Lara Flynn Boyle goes, I can explain. has anyone in any movie ever said, I can explain, and actually explained in a satisfying way?
I mean, she is so, like, fickle in this, just such a femme fatale. Like, you don't trust her an inch. This is also one of the scenes where Cage gets it. Cage fly. Where she's like something about Mexico, and he's like, "Fuck Mexico," and it's like such a good Cage moment. I love it. But you know, rewatching this, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, maybe. But I think the one thing that maybe holds this movie back a little bit is that you never really believe the love story. Like, I like how wary Nicolas Cage is of Lara Flynn Boyle, and I like the femme fatale that she plays. I think she does a great job of having this icy edge where you're like, man, like, what is she thinking?
Yeah.
But you never have that, like, Double Indemnity or Chinatown level of like, oh, these people might actually love each other, and this is all the more tragic for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing that's missing that would, like, drop this into a gear of being absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And so their relationship throughout the movie, I just found myself a little bit like, oh, I don't trust this, but I was waiting for it to sort of do something else, you know, on a rewatch.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it quite does. They're throwing a lot of plot at you here, and it's fascinating for sure. And like, the reversals are great, but this portion of the movie, a little bit, I find it loses a bit of the edge.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to ask about the plot in this section also, because so he says, fuck Mexico. He's going to walk out on her. Dennis Hopper shows up. Lara tells Hopper that she knows J.T. Walsh has hidden $500,000 of this money they stole. Hopper wants the money, so he decides to take Cage and Lara Flynn Boyle with him to try and find this money. Now, it's gotten pretty convoluted at that point, right, in terms of the plot.
For sure.
I never found myself, despite the convolution of it, I never found myself going, all right, this is bullshit. Like, how do you I almost think it's a little bit of the frog in the boiling water analogy, where it's sort of right. Like the insanity of the movie. By the time we've gotten here, so much has happened that you're sort of just like, all right, cool, whatever. Like, how did they get away with it, basically?
I mean, again, it's so clear. Like, I agree with you. Like, it's an incredibly dense plot, but that's never difficult to follow. Like, in terms of unbelievable things in the movie, like, I think the only thing that jumps out at me is when a little bit down the road, when the car jumps the train tracks, I'm just like, I didn't understand why that needed to happen. And I have questions about whether that was part of some other draft where perhaps like those other cops had chased them or seen them leaving the cop station or something like that. But besides that, like, everything in this pretty much tracks, despite how, like you said, convoluted and ridiculous. It's a snake that eats itself and it just keeps going, you know, like, and I think one thing that it does is it does keep, except for that sort of car chase thing, it does keep everything really grounded. So it's back at the bar. I'm jumping back in the movie here, but I love him escaping from Lyle once he realizes that Lyle is Lyle from Dallas and who he's been impersonating.
Yeah.
And they've had their conversation. So he goes out the window and he goes up onto the roof. He doesn't just run away. He doesn't just get away. And he has to get this 2x4 and like put it out over the roof on end to Dwight Yoakam's truck and then sneak over the truck. And I really love low-key realistic action scenes of things that are possible. And it feels to me like Hitchcock, like, you know, the end of North by Northwest when he's climbing up into the house to overhear things, or De Palma, you know, who's doing Hitchcock. Like, but those types of scenes are fascinating and it keeps it grounded. You know, you believe, oh, this guy can do this stuff. Like, you know, Nick Cage is tough in this.
Beautifully shot too.
It is. I mean, it looks fantastic.
All right, we are going to take a quick break for our sponsors. We're going to get to the end of this movie with like 7,000 more twists. We will be right back. Okay, we are back. So Hopper takes Cage and Lara with him to bust JT Walsh out of jail so he can lead them to this money. Dennis Hopper kills a deputy to break JT Walsh out of jail. Consider what this is all based on Lara Flynn Boyle just telling him something. She might be lying for all he knows. Now he's just murdered a cop over it, so he's pretty much going to be on the run for the rest of his life. If they ever catch him, he'll probably get the death penalty. Again, maybe this is 1993. You know, maybe you can get away with killing a cop in 1993 there. Less likely to catch you or something. But he tells JT he'll bust him out of jail in exchange for half of the $500,000. JT agrees. JT, Hopper, Cage, and Lara all get in a car. They're going to go get this money. Hopper, this is when Hopper, like, drops some acid or something. He really, like, went nuts in this scene. He goes from joking around to putting a gun to Nicolas Cage's head to joking around again. How sort of helpful to the balance of the movie is Hopper's like insane sort of funny character where everybody else is deadly serious?
I mean, part of this is like what Dennis Hopper does and his sort of like, you know, fly off the handle craziness. Like, he's got those wild eyes and somehow he sells it. Like, the same way we were talking earlier about Cage being over the top, but it works somehow. Hopper has whatever that is with being a psychopath, you know? Yeah. Like, I, you know, you're totally right that like the shooting the cop thing, he could have tied the guy up and gotten Wayne out or whatever, but you know, he doesn't like loose ends, as he says. I think what they're doing there is establishing that Hopper will kill.
Yes.
So they're setting up for the kind of climax of the movie that this is a guy who doesn't just threaten with a gun, he'll actually shoot and kill somebody if they're in his way. And I think that's crucial for, you know, the feeling of impending danger at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I do think that beat felt, that was the one other thing that felt just a touch heavy-handed. I think it's important for what they do at the end of the movie, but yeah, and then Hopper, you know, he's drinking whiskey and he shoots out his own car window.
Oh God, what a treasure.
Sorry, go ahead.
So they go to a graveyard where this money is supposed to be hidden. Dennis Hopper keeps calling JT Walsh, whose character name is Wayne, Wayner, which I loved. And They could have easily set this scene in like an empty field or like in the forest somewhere. And just the choice to set it in the graveyard, again, is kind of emblematic of the movie. Like, it just makes it a little bit better than it had to be.
Right. And again, it's sort of, you know, it's a choice that in like a lesser filmmaker's hands could have been very, very cliched and cloying. But this movie just sort of keeps going for it. And it keeps working because, like you said earlier, it's elegant, you know? It makes often the obvious choice and then does a nice job of it. And so we accept it instead of being pissed off that it's derivative. Mm.
So JT opens the box the money is hidden in, and there's a gun inside. Hopper throws a knife into his throat. He kind of, as the knife hits him, the gun goes off. The caretaker of the property hears a gunshot. Cage impales Hopper on the bayonet. It's like a statue of a soldier in the graveyard, and there's a bayonet on it, and he impales Hopper on it. So it's like two tons of visual irony. The cops are coming. Cage and Laura hop on a passing train. Laura points a gun at Cage. She wants the money to herself. It's all very classic noir stuff. I guess because I just hadn't seen the movie in so long, I was like, man, maybe they'll run away together. Like, would it have been so unsatisfying to let them actually have a happy ending?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I sort of agree. In a way, everybody gets their just desserts there. You know, the ending I found watching it that it's satisfying generally. Like, everyone kind of gets what's coming to them. But I don't know if it's emotionally moving. And I found that for me, that's what goes back to like what makes this just fall short. And it's that lack of like, what if he really loved her at this point? Mm-hmm. I still, you know, maybe she pulls the gun on him. I mean, that's the double indemnity thing, basically. But that could be, take it to another level. Or have you ever seen, I think it's In a Lonely Place?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it though.
That's a really cool movie. So the ending beat of that movie, I won't give it away, but it's a very sort of tragic, too little, too late type of thing. And I heard somebody talking about tragedy the other day, and like, tragedy is the right answer 2 seconds too late. Ooh. And like, you know, that's that Romeo and Juliet thing. Like, sure. I really like that. That's like, oh, we're so close, but like the fickle gods have sort of cursed us, you know? And I feel like this kind of leaves this. Like, Nicolas Cage is basically back on this. It's like this didn't have to happen to him, you know? Two days before he's a drifter, 2 days after he's a drifter on a train. Like, this crazy thing happened to him, but what, you know, he obviously didn't change. And like, people always talk about arcing characters. And I think one of the sort of things about genre sometimes that people overlook is there are great movies where characters don't really arc. They're just put in intense circumstances.
Here would be my argument. So
she
says, I kind of like you, don't make me shoot you. She pulls the trigger, but it's empty. Hopper had ejected the clip earlier. Cage dumps the money out of the train. That arguably shows his character arc in the sense that he has no money, no longer matters that much to him, where at the beginning he was willing to kind of go along with this for a minute to try to potentially get some money. At the end, he literally just throws the money away, and then he sort of rolls forward to his next destination, and a tiny bit of the cash is stuck in the train car, so he pockets it, which is a very sort of classic Western drifter kind of ending. So I'm curious if that lands for you at all in terms of arc.
No, I think that's true. It's an interesting point. I think he, you know, he doesn't just throw money away. He throws dirty money away. Mm-hmm. The thing that has like caused him this problem this entire time. Right. And I guess by throwing it away, he's rewarded with the initial $5,000 or $10,000 that he sort of wanted. Like, he has one band of bills at the end. Right. So it's like, he's gone through all this. Like, would he have accepted that job at the beginning if that he knew that was the job description? Like, no way, you know, but he's gone through it. And so I guess he's rewarded for returning to his code, I suppose. Hmm. But yeah, I still found the end just a touch down, you know, like the movie is so clever, particularly for the first half where you're just like, oh my God, this is good. You know, they keep doing this.
The first half of this movie is unbelievably good.
For sure. And it sets up so much. And, you know, what it sets up is beautifully layered. Like, I often find when you're writing something, you get sort of towards the end, you have a good idea. And if you're smart, what you do is you go back and you set it up. Yep. And, you know, it seems like all coherent, but really it's constructed and you've had a good idea. Now you need to make it make sense. And the first act of this movie kind of makes almost everything make sense. Like, it's got all the twists and turns, but like, you could figure out everything that's coming, you know?
I was wondering also, like, so at the very, very end of this, right, as he sort of, the train goes and it's like, hey, goodbye, Red Rock, and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, it made me think, at the time, this wouldn't have been as crazy of an idea. Like, if they actually just did it as a Western, I mean, almost like if they could we remake this as a Western, would it have been a better movie in a way, potentially?
That's interesting. I mean, I think in the 90s, there really was that, like, push for neo-noir, which is, you know, one of my favorite genres. So, like, I'm not apt to complain. But this probably has more of its essence as a Western and its construction as a noir, if that makes sense.
It's a modern day Western, right? It's like No Country for Old Men is like that. They're using...
Yep.
It's a plot that you could easily do as a Western plot without changing. You would need to change almost nothing.
Yep.
And I think just in terms of, for me, the opportunity to like really dig into like iconography and make the characters a little bit more crazy and sort of like that sense of like no one is coming to help, right? Which in a civilized society, there are obviously repercussions, but in a Western, you can kind of have it where it's just... It's almost like they are in their own sort of story universe and there's no one else coming. Like,
yep. No, I think that's a really interesting point. It probably would have been even more sort of coherent, you know, if it had stuck strictly to that. I mean, I think at that time, the Western was considered sort of dead, right? It's a genre that sort of like goes back and forth into favor or no favor. And people say it's dead. And then somebody makes a really good one. And all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, I love Westerns. And it's, you know, for sure the most American of genres. Like the whole thing is about what America is and what identity is. And the, you know, the man in the white hat coming to save the townspeople. And that's the hero that we want. Yeah, I mean...
I feel like this would be, like, the most unpopular pitch of all time to, like, take to, like, a Netflix or somebody like that. It's like, hey, let's do Red Rock West as a Western. It's, like, a somewhat obscure movie in, like, a super obscure genre. But I think it would actually be fucking cool.
I mean, have you read... I think that'd be great, too. Have you read, like, any of the stuff about how it sort of came to be distributed and that? Like, it's a fascinating story.
It sounded like basically everybody was like, we don't know how to market this. It's sort of a Western. It's sort of, like... It's sort of a noir, but it's like kind of like a little bit of everything. And then they just sort of like kind of farted it out. And it just sort of eventually found an audience because it's good. But it seems like they sort of abandoned it in the release.
I mean, yeah, apparently like none of the executives showed up to like the preview screening, you know, like that type of just like we're killing this thing on arrival, essentially. And there's, you know, a quote from the New York Times of a guy saying, yeah, exactly what you just said. It's half a Western, half a noir. Like, we don't know how to market this.
Can you imagine? And
that's awful.
You're John Dahl and you're like, I've made this movie, it's so good. And no one, they're just like, screw it.
I think he outlasted a lot of those people would be my guess. But yeah, I mean, so then it got shown at a film festival in Paris. The director of the Toronto International Film Festival saw it there and was like, this is a great movie. Showed it at TIFF. A guy who owns a movie theater in San Francisco saw it at TIFF and was like, it had already been shown, they'd gone kind of direct to cable at that point. And it had been shown on TV a couple of times, which is a travesty for a movie this good. And he started showing it as theater. It broke box office records for his little review theater in San Francisco. And so he took it out on the road and like he essentially gave it a theatrical release.
Wow.
And I think Gene Siskel backing it up was a big deal and Roger Ebert backing it up was a big deal, which is cool when critics had that sort of sway. Sure. And those guys are both legends just to be like, no, this is a good movie by a good filmmaker. And I mean, Ebert has a great quote about the movie that I think like really sums up why it's fun. And it says, it's the kind of movie made by people who love movies, have had some good times at them and want to celebrate the very texture of old genres like the Western and the film noir.
Yeah. Perfect.
And that's why it's delightful.
It's also a good lesson for writers in the sense of like, if you have a good piece of material, if you just keep showing it to people, eventually you will find the champions for it who will just show it to more people. And, you know, the sort of the second life of this movie where people still, you know, I mean, like even me just saying that I'm doing it on the show, people kind of come out of the woodwork like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, Red Rock West. Like it is a movie that has survived because it's good, you know.
I think, you know, most of your favorite filmmakers or whatever at some point have like worked in noir. It's like this genre that captivates the people who make the types of movies that I want to make and seem to move through the industry. And I think that taste is quite universal across like a whole lot of types of people in the industry. Everyone looks at each other like it's a dirty little secret almost, you know? They're like, oh, people don't watch those types of movies or whatever. Yeah. Critics don't like those types of movies, but it just keeps happening. Like you can think about almost any filmmaker, what's their first movie? It's probably a little B-grade noir. Like,
yeah, I mean, for any fans of noir, we have a previous episode of the show about Frailty, and the guy who wrote Frailty is like an expert on noir and spoke very eloquently about noir and why he thinks it's like the most important genre in film. And that movie is also a great noir. Okay, that is our time. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. I want to thank my guest, Daniel Cameron. Until next time, bye-bye.